United States, Etrel Benson Childs et al. Versus Cook Inc. et al. And BMO Capital Markets Corp. And Mr. DeMay, I see you reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, and you can begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. Defendants defrauded the government out of valuable natural resources. Congress declared the natural resources here to be, quote, a form of national wealth. Valuable natural resources on public lands are public property. Defendants' scheme is property fraud under the FCA. There are three claims to discuss. First, Congress has already confirmed that the natural resource taken by fraud, fish in public waters, is government property. But even under defendant's theory, we still prevail, because if fish do not become property until they are caught, they are government property then under this court's binding ruling in Vegas, followed in the 4th, 6th, 10th circuits, and multiple district courts around the country, including by Your Honor, Judge Brianco and Hotel.
Well, how did you make a claim for that?
I'm sorry?
How do you make a claim? How did someone make a claim for them?
Under the FCA?
Yeah.
Under that provision, which is subparagraph D,
yeah.
It's a conversion claim, which does not require a submission of a claim. Under the text of the FCA, because it's conversion.
Well, but conversion requires delivery or causes to be delivered.
It's
There's
a
no
failure.
Delivery.
It's the failure to deliver.
No, I'll read you the statute. Any person who has possession, custody, or control of property or money used to be used by the government and knowingly delivers or causes to be delivered. It's the past delivers or the past partial causes to be delivered. There's no delivery.
Read the remainder of the statute.
I'll be happy to. Less than all the money or property is liable to the United States government.
Right, so the defendants delivered zero. So that's why it is a conversion. They wrongfully retained government property that they did not have and did not have a right to possess.
Can you clarify something for me about that theory? There's a couple of different steps, right? The first step is that this has to be government property, and you rely on Bengus. And Bengus relied on a very specific South Africa statute that essentially we interpreted as vesting title in the South African government upon the moment of an unlawful taking. Can you tell me what statute you're relying on here to carry forward the analogy from Bengus?
Yes, Ocean Pro in the Fourth Circuit applied to Virginia law, Virginia statute, which is the same statute that we rely on, it's cited in our brief.
And it's a forfeiture statute. It's a statute
yes.
That says it can be subject to forfeiture. So in your view, is that the same thing as the South Africa statute?
Yes, they're completely indistinguishable. That's what Ocean Pro said. That's what the district court held in Winkler, relying, Judge Bianco, on your decision in Cookout.
So if it is property and it's under the Virginia statute, then it's Virginia state property. And I understand for purposes of the other subsection of the False Claims Act, I recognize the argument that you've made as to why something being state property can translate into a false claim. But under subsection D, I'm less clear as to how property that, in your view, once it's caught, is the property of the state of Virginia, is property used or to be used by the federal government. Can you help me understand how that piece of the statute fits to your theory?
Yes, just as in Bengus, this court said the government can seize and sell the fish. And a plain meaning of use includes selling. So what the defendants did was prevent the government from seizing the fish and selling.
But it doesn't say that could be used by the government. It just says used or to be used by the government.
Exactly, but that's what this court held in Bengus, is that the fish would be sold if it were seized.
Well, Bengus was a different statute, wasn't it? Wasn't that a restitution statute?
There was a restitution, yes, but the question was whether there was a government property right.
Right, but in terms of parsing the language of the False Claims Act and how it applies to that theory, that's not something we did in Bengus, or am I misremembering?
Bengus was not a False Claims Act.
Okay.
Case.
So now I'm asking you to really take this concept that this is under the Bengus theory, this is property of the state of Virginia, and I'm asking you to parse the False Claims Act subsection that you're relying on with that concept and tell me how it being property of the state of Virginia makes it property used or to be used by the federal government.
Well, a couple of points. One, there's also a federal statute, which is 1857 and 1860, which we cited our brief. So it's not just the Virginia state statute that creates a property right in the government. It's also a federal statute that creates a property right in the federal government.
So I guess it's not an exclusive property right. They can't both have fee simple ownership of the fish.
The district court in Winkler acknowledged that both governments would have the property right under these parallel statutes. But to go back to parsing the conversion section of the statute, the property is to be used by the government.
The federal
used
government.
By the government. Either the state government or...
Well, the statute puts a capital G in the government. I mean, in that subsection, tell me where you're getting a state government. Where do you get the bridge from the state government to the federal government?
I think the amendment to the FCA clarifies that it applies to property. Whether or not the government owns title to the property would still apply. But
that language is in the definition of a false claim, which isn't part of this subsection you're relying on.
I still think it applies, but even assuming that there's a federal statute that gives the federal government a seizure.
Isn't there also a procedural problem? The district court said that it was too late, that the amendment was too late.
Right.
Why did the district court abuse its discretion in saying this should have been raised earlier? It's unclear to me why it wasn't raised earlier.
The decision was grounded in an error of law because the claim is not futile. So because it was grounded in an error of law, it's
Well, then the district court just said there was an opportunity to amend earlier. It wasn't just futility. It clearly said this should have been brought earlier, right?
The district court did not follow its own order on that point. The district court said there's a motion to dismiss that's been filed. You have an opportunity to amend in response to the arguments made in that motion. We amended in response to the arguments made in that motion. Then, after we amended the complaint, there were new developments. After we amended the complaint, there were new developments. And the amendment, the proposed amendment, responds to those new...
Why couldn't you make this conversion claim? What was the new development that made this conversion claim viable that
right.
didn't exist previously?
One of them was this court's decision in Miller, which interpreted the reverse false claims provision for the first time. And we were going to bring the Bengus claim under the reverse. We were going to make the Bengus argument as a reverse false claim. That was the point.
All right. Let me just ask, because you raised Miller in connection with the reverse false claim, you don't even cite Miller in your reply. Miller clearly says that if it's discretionary whether or not a civil penalty can be imposed, that it's not an obligation. So doesn't Miller control this case on that claim?
Our argument is completely consistent with Miller. Miller says if it is discretionary by statute, then the reverse false claim provision does not apply.
No, in Miller, the language was shall forfeit. The language of the statute was shall forfeit. And we said, in no uncertain terms, that's still discretionary because an agency always has the decision whether or not to investigate and to whether or not to impose the penalty. And that's certainly true here.
I think that's not quite right, Your Honor. I think what Miller said was the statute does say shall forfeit. A different section of the statute also says that it's not really mandatory and the agency does have the discretion to not impose.
You're saying the Maritime Administration has to investigate and impose a civil penalty in every single situation? That can't be true.
If the argument is about general prosecutorial discretion, every circuit court to consider this question after the 2009 amendment to the FCA, which added the whether or not fixed language, has agreed that the prosecutorial discretion theory does not work, including Fourth Circuit in Wheeler, which says expressly.
Except we have said otherwise in Miller.
No, the
we have said as long as there is prosecutorial discretion in Miller, then it's not an obligation. Isn't that what I could read you multiple quotes from Miller where we say exactly that?
What Miller says is it's in the statute, the discretion is in the statute, then that's one thing. But if the statute itself is mandatory and you're talking about just background prosecutorial discretion, all the other circuits to have considered the question have held that's not enough.
All right.
Let
me just ask you a question about your first claim. I don't quite understand. We'll put aside whether or not it's dicta or not, because I don't want to debate that too much. But I think you would agree that Douglas, Hughes, and Long Cove all say that states do not have ownership in wild fish. Would you agree with that? That they, I mean, it couldn't be clearer in Douglas and in Hughes. It's called a pure fiction. And in Long Cove, we said wild fish, birds, and animals are owned by no one. Property rights in them are obtained by reducing them to possession, right? I know you argue that it's dicta and we shouldn't follow it, but don't all those cases stand for that proposition?
Our primary argument is not really that it's dicta, it's that they're not interpreting the Submerged Lands Act. And the Submerged Lands Act is crystal clear, and it means what it says, and the history shows that it was intended to mean.
Douglas, there's a whole discussion of the Submerged Land Act in Douglas, and then it says, in any event, even absent these federalism concerns that were present in Douglas, fish are owned by no one.
That paragraph is not discussing the Submerged Lands Act. So that section of the opinion, it begins with a roadmap and it addresses the state's final counterarguments. And the state was relying on two different sources of law for its conclusion. States own their fish, and therefore state regulation trumps federal law. And the first source that the states relied on was the Submerged Lands Act. The Submerged Lands Act gives us ownership, and therefore we confront federal power. And the second source of law the states were relying on was cases that predate the statute.
These cases all stand for the proposition, whether it's the Submerged Land Act or in Long Cove, a New York statute, that no state statute can make wild fish ownership. They can't do it. They just can't do it.
That is not what this court said in Douglas. That's not what this court said in Long Cove. They're not interpreting the Submerged Lands Act in this discussion.
So when we say in connection with the New York statute, where the New York state said, we own the fish, and we said, you can't own the fish. There's no such thing. But when the Submerged Land Act says that, then it's okay. It makes no sense.
The property right at issue is a creation of, it's a judge-made law. The legislature is always free to create a property right. And Douglas says in the paragraph about the Submerged Lands Act, this was a grant pursuant to the property clause. And the court said in the helpful, useful paragraph that's actually discussing the statute at issue, the act, quote, does give the states title and ownership and regulatory power.
Well, let me just ask you, this was raised in the amicus brief, but it was also raised by the parties, that there's a concern that somehow if we were to conclude that fish are not property consistent with these other cases, that somehow the states would be unable to regulate this type of activity. But that's not the case, right? The power to regulate can exist. They could have the same power to regulate as if they owned it, even though it's a pure fiction.
Right,
but they own,
right? Our argument is that these are valuable natural resources. Congress declared them to be a form of national wealth, said in unambiguous explicit terms that the states own them and do not have merely a regulatory interest in them, and they're valuable natural resources, and when they're taken by fraud, the False Claims Act should apply. These principles have been applied to oil in the Abbott case that we signed before.
But isn't oil, I mean, I it seems to me the case law treats oil as different from the way it treats wild swimming fish, because oil is fixed under the surface,
right,
and the fish are swimming around.
No, Your Honor, the Submerged Lands Act resolves this question. The definition of natural resources in the Submerged Lands Act includes oil, minerals, gas, fish, shrimp,
under the territorial waters, right?
Yes, that's right, Your Honor. And the whole point of the Submerged Lands Act was to resolve all of these questions, including oil, including fish. Congress specifically said, we're looking at these 1800s cases about state ownership of fish, including McCready and Manchester and all the cases we cite. Congress says, we think these cases are rightly decided, and we're concerned that the Supreme Court has started to back away from them. We want, our goal with this statute is to codify the earlier law, because we're worried the judiciary is going to cut them.
No, wait a minute.
That's what the district court exactly did.
The goal was to return to the pre-U.S. v. California law, which was very specific as to the sort of fee simple ownership of the seabed for purposes of oil. All of these older cases weren't changed by U.S. v. California insofar as they talked about wild migratory animals. And so if we're going back to Geer and Hermes and Holland and all of those, they make it very clear that wild birds, while the sovereign may have a sovereign right to regulate, they are not proprietors of those. Are you suggesting that all those old cases suggest that the government, whether it's the state government or the federal government, has a proprietary ownership? And if so, can you show me where the cases say that rather than specifically describing the ownership as a sovereign ownership?
The Submerged Lands Act said.
No, no, but you said the Submerged Lands Act was designed to restore the law from these older cases.
Yes.
I never found the law in the older cases that you're saying were being restored, and I'm asking you to point me to a statement in one of the older cases that supports your view.
Yes, that would be in McCready, Manchester, Arnold, and the other cases that we cite. And Congress specifically cited individual cases, including the ones I just mentioned. And they said these cases are correctly decided, and we are concerned that the judiciary is going to stop applying those cases. And Congress predicted the future accurately, because that's what the district court did.
The problem I have with this just doesn't work well. I mean, this is an application for you. You've made an application. You claim that the other side made an application for a license, right? And that they weren't entitled to the license because of their foreign ownership, correct? Correct?
They were not entitled because of
had they caught not a single fish, there'd be no claim, correct?
I'm sorry?
Had they caught not a single fish, would they still have violated the, there'd be no quitam, correct?
That's not the circumstance here.
No, just answer my question.
Yes, there's a lot.
See, that's how it works. I ask you a question, and I'd prefer that you answered my question.
Yes, Your Honor. There's a lot of law on this question. As I understand the law, there's a lot of authority to the effect that it does not matter whether the government shows the loss, because one of the goals of the statute is to prevent fraud against
but,
the government.
But we know that the license is not property. The Supreme Court's already told us that.
That's not the theory. The theory is that the fish are a problem.
But if you caught enough, but the only thing that you lied about was your entitlement to a, that you claim that they lied about is their entitlement to a license.
The legal test is whether the false statement is integral to a causal chain leading to obtaining property.
Well, and all the causal chain cases that you talked about is where you submit a fraudulent voucher into one agency that then monitors it, and then the payment comes from another. So, I mean, that's like, You put your request in one slot, and the check comes out the other slot. But that's not this. This is a causal chain and more of a causal, like almost a negligence kind of an action. But where because we misrepresented our ownership with regard to our license, ultimately we stole the government's fish.
It's not a long attenuated causal chain. This is the center of the whole enterprise. Foregone conclusion they would obtain fish. And the case I would point to is the Abbott case, the oil case. There, the defendants had a drilling lease to drill for oil on federal land, and then they also had to obtain a permit to drill, to take the oil out of the ground. And in that application for a permit, they lied. And the court said, well, this is clearly a claim to obtain property, it's the oil.
There's an inherent difference between a mineral right, isn't there, and the wild flora and fauna that exist and are migratory with regard to territorial waters. I mean, the amici brief talks about the public trust doctrine and it's hard to dispute that there's a definite government interest in the wildlife that exists within the confines of the national boundaries and on federal land or on state land. But then the question is there a proprietary interest, kind of like in a fee simple absolute idea? And that's where we get into problems. Your view is that it's fee simple absolute, right?
My view is you just have to read the Submerged Lands Act, and you must presume that the legislature means in the statute what it says and says in the statute what it means. Here, the 1311A1 says the states have title to and ownership of the natural resources in their waters, including oil, fish, shrimp, crabs, oysters.
All right, we know the language. Yeah. We know the language of the act.
Well,
so
I think it's important to come back to it,
right,
because we're not making
right
broader arguments about common law and constitutional law.
We'll come back to it in the rebuttal. Let's give them a chance. We've gone 10 minutes over. All right, thanks. All right, Mr. Ellis.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Jonathan Ellis, on behalf of defendants. I want to start just by taking a step back. This case, at bottom, is about an alleged violation of the American Fisheries Act. That is a regulatory scheme that is enforced and administered by the Coast Guard and the Maritime Administration, not private parties. Those entities are fully aware of the corporate structure, leadership and the agreements that the defendants have in relating to their application for fishing license. They brought no enforcement action. So we're here under the False Claims Act. But the FCA is a case, is a statute about fraud and protecting the government from the traditional property rights. And even accepting all of my friend's allegations as true, they cannot and have not identified any traditional property rights that the government has.
Where does it say traditional property right? It just says money or property.
It does, but the court has interpreted that to speak to traditional property rights. Kasowitz is very clear on that. And Cleveland, and then the courts have looked to cases like Cleveland and Carpenter, who interpreted similar fraud statutes. The reason, I think, is number one, the False Claims Act was enacted to protect against fraud and defense contracts. It was all about protecting the government's property interests. And the second, as the court described, Supreme Court described in the end, this is a statute that carries criminal penalties and severe civil penalties. And so it needs to be read narrowly as only to reach those traditional property interests. My friends actually, I don't think, dispute that proposition. They cited Cleveland below, they cited Carpenter below, they said they identified a traditional property interest, and I think we continue to advocate that here this morning based on the submerged but the problem for my friends is that the Supreme Court has already interpreted that act consistent with a long line of cases that we've already spoken about this morning. That title in wild, that no one has title, it's a traditional property interest in wild animals, and the Submerged Lands Act reference to title and ownership is like the references in Beer, MacReady, and Manchester, a reference to a legal fiction that represents the state's powerful regulatory interest in wild animals. That doesn't mean that states can't regulate the capture of wild animals. Indeed, they do. Virginia has its own licensing scheme that we comply with here. But it does mean that they lack a traditional property interest.
So when you're jumping to the property interest argument as it relates to fish, you're skipping over your first argument, which is that there's never a claim asking for fish. It was a claim asking for a license. But it was a license to get fish. And I'm wondering whether you think Abbott was wrongly decided that a similar application to drill wasn't really a request for oil.
No, so we absolutely stand by our first argument that there hasn't been a claim for fish. The only thing that's ever been demanded of the federal government is a fishing license, and I'd love to address.
So I want to ask you then, does that mean that a false representation in an application for a drilling permit isn't subject to the False Claims Act because you're only getting a permit, you're not getting the oil?
No, we take the issue with Abbott or the oil case.
So what's the distinction as to the question of whether a license is as tantamount to a request for the thing you're licensed to get?
So from top to bottom, the federal government's leasing program for oil is an economic enterprise. They are doling out their property first in the land. So if you look at Abbott, the first step is a federal lease, at least a federal land. That's obviously a traditional property interest. And then part and parcel of that, condition of that, is in the seeking a further permit to drill for the oil. What Abbott said is that that permit is part and parcel of the lease itself. So part of that property interest.
And wouldn't it be?
Because the oil's not going anywhere. The oil is either there or it's not there. And traditionally there's a mineral right interest in ownership of the land above the oil, and so it makes perfect sense that a mineral right, a permit to drill, and if you find the oil, then that's the property. If you don't find the oil, there's nothing there. But the fish, a fish who's swimming in the territorial waters of the United States, so 3 miles off the coast of Virginia, who's vigorous enough to swim across the barrier and get into Virginia water, is suddenly the title is lost and becomes the property of the state of Virginia. It's hard to kind of fit those traditional property ideas onto a migratory animal.
That's right. That's
but you're asking us to make a broader proposition, which is, just going back to Judge Robinson's question, that any time that an entity in connection with getting, let's assume there is a federal right, property right here, or federal money, that if there's some application process, whether it be a licensing, a permit, an approval process to sort of get into the program, that if you lie in those applications, as long as you're not getting money at that point, and that the money is only going to come later when you put in a voucher or some other claim, that somehow all those false statements in all those types of applications, which are pretty standard, would be not actionable under the False Claims Act. And wouldn't that be a problem?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
I mean, they do cite all these cases, they're not, you know, not our cases, but the Ninth Circuit and other circuits have said, as he noted, if a false statement is integral to, in the causal chain, and certainly under that definition, this was integral to the causal chain of being able to fish, you had to do this, right?
Yeah, so those, they're just addressing
those cases are wrong?
No, absolutely not. They're just addressing a different concept. Right? Those places say, if there is a claim, even if it's a multi-step process, if at the end of the day there is a request of the government, demand of the government for money or property, that a false statement that's made earlier in that process gets to another agency or just an earlier step, if that false statement is integral to the claim, then it can be the subject of a false claim.
It's a claim for a sum of money that begins at agency X and ends up coming out at agency Y.
Right, that's the Gilead Sciences case, Your Honor. I think Maine v. Oakland City University and U.S. Riviera, I think we're both the same subject, but they're just multi-step processes.
But these aren't claims. These aren't claims for fish. They're claims for the right to fish.
The key is there's actually a claim in every one of those cases. At the end of the day, there was a request for property. So contrast that with Minch and Duver, where there is a request of the government for something valuable, right? But there is never a claim, a demand for actual property.
Although it was interesting because Minch sort of reserved the question of what would have happened had there actually been a claim on the insurance and payment made from the government, and whether the initial lie in the application for the insurance would have, right? So
yeah.
So I wouldn't say that, I think the fact that McNinch expressly left that question open doesn't suggest that it's closed, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, what I'm trying to say is that it's not closed, right? If the hypothetical there, if there's a false statement at one part of the process, and there is subsequently a claim for money or property that false statement enabled, there has not been a claim, and you can ask whether that previous false statement is integral to the final claim.
But if the false statement is in an application for a and if the application is in an application for a license, let's say, going back to the oil example, to drill,
yes.
And I fully understand your argument and my colleague's argument that there's a difference between oil and swimming fish as it relates to their status as property.
Yes.
But now we're sort of stepping back and asking the prior question, which is whether the license, when it is a license that authorizes you to go grab that property, is itself property. And so you, I think, have acknowledged that it is when you're getting licensed to go grab oil. But I think what you're saying is it's not when you're licensed to go grab fish.
Something that Cleveland says is when a license is not property in the hands of the government, when it is an exercise of the government's regulatory authority. And I think in this situation, there's really no question that what the AFA is, it's a regulatory scheme. And the government is exercising regulatory authority when it issues a fishing endorsement, a license that issues. After all, my friend's only plausible argument for a property right here is it's the state's property, not the federal government's. So the federal government is obviously exercising regulatory.
Yep.
In the oil example, the regulatory action.
In the oil thing, it's like salt mining, which is well known in my area of the state. You know, when one gets a permit to go down into the ground to look for salt, they're acquiring also the right to then accumulate, to take the salt if it's found. And so there is a sale of a mineral interest at the time of the issuance of the permit, right?
Yes. Yes, I mean, and I think to look at it, I think the other thing I would add to that is that it's not just the permit to get oil, it is the whole scheme, right? It is from top to bottom an exercise of the government's economic
Can I ask you to take a minute to address the conversion claim?
Yes, happy to do that, Your Honor. The problem with the conversion claim is the same problem sort of at the bottom with their reverse false claim. And private parties, persons are not under an obligation to identify their own violation of civil or criminal law and then report themselves to the federal government or be subject to a false claim in which they would have to pay not just whatever penalty the law provides, but treble damages. The claim under the conversion claim would operate in the exact same way as the reverse false claim. Under their view, because fish that are unlawfully harvested are subject to forfeiture, we had an obligation to then identify that violation, come to the government, and deliver the fish, or be subject to a reverse false claim.
I realize it wasn't a false claims case, but in the Bengus case, it was a similar construct, right? The governor of South Africa had the authority to come seize something, but for purposes at least of restitution, the court said, no, it was already theirs by virtue of that statute that does look an awful lot like the statutes here.
Right, so I'd say a couple things about Bengus. The first is I do think it's important to know that those are cases about restitution. The definition of property in the restitution statute is given a broader interpretation because it is a remedial statute. It is not one that cares about imposing criminal or civil penalties. But even accepting that they're sort of property, that the fish now is the government's property. As you pointed out, Your Honor, there are other obligations, other provisions and requirements in the statute to make out a conversion claim. It must be something that at least you have an obligation to deliver, if not actually deliver. And I think when you get into the context of a false claim as opposed to restitution, there has already been a conviction, whether there isn't any concerns about having to turn yourself in and prosecutorial discretion, you run into the exact same problem, the conversion claim that you run into for the reverse false claim that this court rejected in Miller.
All right, thank you. Mr. DeMay, you have 2 minutes in rebuttal.
There's a second colleague.
I'm sorry. Yes, that's my fault. Ms. Sitescu, you have 2 minutes. I'm sorry. Did I pronounce that correctly?
It's Celeste.
Celeste, okay.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I represent BMO Capital Markets, and I'm just here to address if the court has any questions about our alternative arguments for affirmance. It seems now that the case has really shifted into focus on conversion, and as you can imagine, our arguments are similar there, that my client really had nothing to do with anything after the financing. The only allegations in the complaint related to its purchase and marketing and sale of notes related to the acquisition, really far removed from anything related to fishing. So at this point, Your Honor, if there's no questions, we just ask that the court consider the affirming on the alternative grounds, if necessary, for my client.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. DeMay, now you have 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The take versus deliver distinction is totally unsupported. They don't cite anything in support of it, and it's an arbitrary distinction. Going back to the oil example, our friend says that the oil is different because there's an economic interest at stake. That's already been rejected. There's one case that has been cited by any party that is by far the closest to this fact situation. It's the Tomlinson case, which we cite in our reply. And in that case specifically holds that the federal government has a property interest in wild animals on federal land, not just a regulatory interest. And it specifically considers and rejects the argument that because the government doesn't sell wild animals on federal property, then the federal government doesn't have a property interest.
But you would agree that the licensing scheme is more in a regulatory nature as opposed to a sale of fish.
The court in Tomlinson rejected that same argument because there was a licensing regime there about whether an individual could take one of these wild animals, and the defendants just didn't follow that. They committed a regulatory violation and took one. And the court said in Tomlinson, well, this is nevertheless interference with the property interest in addition to being a regulatory violation.
But the purpose of the license was to regulate with regard to the taking of fish. Right?
And it's not just that, Your Honor. I think this is very important. This is a valuable natural resource.
Did the license have on a quantity amount that was limited? Or was that established elsewhere?
No, Your Honor. But it is still protecting a property.
So it's hard to equate it as like a sale, isn't it? It's not really a sales document. It's a permission to go and capture.
Correct.
Correct?
The court in Tomlinson said this is...
So it's not a sale, it's clearly not a sale of a property interest, it's a sale of an opportunity.
Correct, and the court in Tomlinson said this is interference with the property interest, even though the government
so
is not
what is
selling.
So what is the property interest, the opportunity or its eventuation?
It is the tangible item. That is the property interest that's being interfered. The tangible item. That's what the court said in Tomlinson. The court said it's immaterial that the government does not charge for it because it could decide to do that at any time.
So it's only when you catch the fish that the ketam ripens.
In that scenario, then Bengus applies squarely.
So clearly the license is not a sale of a fish, it's just the opportunity to fish.
It is a grant of, it is a, an approval
it's a privilege.
Of permission to take fish.
Sounds like a regulatory grant.
It is all, it is regulatory, it is also a grant of a property.
Okay.
But back to Vengus, this is not a situation where I am imposing a duty to self-report. The defendants affirmatively each year made false statements to cover up their previous illegal fishing. They took it upon themselves to speak on that subject, and when they did that, they lied, and they covered up their previous illegal fishing.
All right.
So this is just like Vengus, and Vengus is binding. It's been applied all across the country in other circuits, and the district court just got it wrong. The district court said Vengus was just about a regulatory interest. And that's not a defensible reading of Vengus.
All right.
The court says this is a property interest that, quote, goes beyond the mere regulatory interest.
All
that's
right. Thank you.
Held, and Your Honor, held in
Thank you, Mr. DeMay. Thank you to everyone. We'll reserve decision. Have a good day.